This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How do you find out if there's a secret room hidden in an ancient pyramid? Not the same way you'd discover hidden places in that home you're remodeling. You just can't go busting through the walls to find out what's on the other side, right? So how do you do it? Case in point, a group of scientists recently suspected that there might be an undiscovered chamber hidden in the Great Pyramid of Giza. Following up on their hunch, they turned to a technique scientists used to measure the density of volcanoes to try and see if there was anything behind that earth and stone besides, well, more earth and stone. So did they find anything? The suspense is killing me, so let's find out. Joining us to discuss this and other short subjects in science, Annalee Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's continue this story. So you have this room is hidden. How do they know that?
So the north side of the Great Pyramid at Giza has this characteristic architectural feature that suggests that somebody might have wanted to hold up a ceiling behind the outer wall of the pyramid. So scientists thought, well, maybe there's something behind. Maybe there's a chamber behind there. The problem is, as you said, you can't just dig it up or break into it. So what they did was they used a technique called muography, not photography. Muography works with subatomic particles called muons that are created through collisions in the upper atmosphere, and they rain down on Earth at a very regular rate. And the thing that's great about muons is they can pass through incredibly dense amounts of earth and stone, but they sometimes get absorbed the denser it gets. And so if you go into one of the lower areas of the Great Pyramid, there's a few corridors in there that we've opened up. They went into a corridor under the area where they thought there was this possible chamber and set up plates that capture muons and left them there for 3 months and went back to see basically the absorption patterns of those muons to see how many were absorbed and how many got through and if there was a pattern. And they found there was a pattern that looks like there may be a void space somewhere in the pyramid right behind that architectural feature.
So they saw a shadow like you would see on an X-ray instead of muons coming where X-rays would be coming in.
That's right. So you're using muons instead of X-rays, and they're just coming down from the atmosphere.
Yeah. Just to make sure that we say no cows were harmed in this experiment.
That's right.
So did they find? They got. So what do they do now? I mean, they know it's there. They can't get in? Can they?
So right now, the group, which is called the Scan Pyramids Mission, is hoping to get another year to do more research, to basically do more muography, because they want to make sure that what they're seeing is actually some kind of chamber instead of just the muons picking up, you know, spaces between the stones. It's possible that there's larger stones and smaller stones that have gaps between them. So they don't want to, you know, do anything to harm this wonder of the world until they really are certain that there's something there. So first, another year of gathering muons, and then they'll see what they're going to do next.
I think there's a song here somewhere about gathering muons. But let's move on to your next story that's out of Brazil about some monkeys that were spotted banging rocks together. I don't get it. What's so special about that?
So these are capuchin monkeys, very cute monkeys that were spotted by some researchers in a Brazilian national park. And they're banging rocks together. So they're using rocks as tools, which is great. They're using one rock as a hammer. And they're exhibiting this odd behavior where they smash the rocks together and then lick the rocks. So we're not sure why they're doing that. But an even bigger mystery is the fact that in banging the rocks together, they were able to produce what are called flake tools. They're basically just flakes of rock, but they look exactly like the kinds of tools that our early hominin ancestors used over 3 million years ago when they were first developing sharp tools for cutting and scraping. So basically what these monkeys have done is something that scientists didn't think that any other species could do, which is by banging two rocks together, they've created a third kind of rock that would be an ideal tool.
Well, we don't know if they actually use them as tools. We just know they made the rocks, right?
In fact, we know for sure they're not using them as tools. Yeah. So this is not a story about monkeys suddenly learning to use knives, which would be a little bit terrifying. But what they're doing is, because they're creating these flake tools. They're not tools. They're rock flakes that look like tools. What it tells us is that there wasn't something special about our ancestors that they could create that kind of rock shape. Mm-hmm. It has been believed and been proposed that part of the way that humans kind of evolved to use tools was that some human at some point, some early hominin, you know, had this great idea, if I bang two rocks together, I can create a kind of a sharp knife-like tool. Well, that's not the case, because now we know that that monkeys can accidentally create these knife-like tools by banging rocks together. So the sort of missing link in terms of how humans had that brilliant idea to start using sharpened stones as knives, it must have come later. Yeah. Maybe they were accidentally creating these kinds of flakes and then decided, let's use them to cut some meat up.
Yeah, finally we have something new. We've learned about the culture of sperm whales. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, I love this story. So one of the things that I think the public may not be aware of is that a lot of marine biologists who study whales, sperm whales and other whales, widely accept that sperm whales create cultures. They create clans where they speak distinctive dialects. They communicate in a series of cliques. And each of the clans, actually, scientists name them after the characteristic cliques that they use to identify each other and to communicate underwater. And so some of the groups are called things like regular and short, just to, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
describe the cliques they use.
Yeah.
Different clans. And so what recently a group of scientists found is that not only do these clans speak the same language, but they actually move together. So if they decide to leave an area, they all leave at once. And there were these two clans off the coast of the Galapagos Islands that used to hang out all the time in the 80s and 90s, and then they just disappeared. And there were no whales there for a very long time. And then a few years ago, two new clans came into the area. So basically what we're seeing here is kind of like neighborhood turnover. Basically, this neighborhood had these two clans. They left, and two totally new groups moved in and started, moved in, took over the food chain there, and, started acting like sperm whales.
Whale gentrification going on right there in the neighborhood.
It could be whale gentrification, yeah. It could, or just could be new immigrants to the area, just
there you
setting
go.
Up shop.
There you go. Thank you. Thank you, Annalie.
Yeah,
always good to have you. Annalie Newitz is a tech culture editor for Ars Technica. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Last December, 195 countries signed the Paris Climate Agreement. Each country pledged to curb emissions to keep global temperatures increase, keep it under 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And countries will meet every 5 years to set even higher targets. Pretty ambitious goal. Well, this week, over 100 countries signed a smaller but no less ambitious climate change agreement. The target? Phasing out hydrofluorocarbons, or HRCs. These are the chemicals in your air conditioner and your refrigerators. My next guest is here to break down that agreement. John Upton is a senior science writer for Climate Central, based out of New York, in our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
What is the problem raised by the HFCs here?
To understand that, it helps to really think back to the 1980s when we discovered that the ozone layer was in a lot of trouble. And the reason the ozone layer was in trouble was because of these chemicals called CFCs. So the world got together very quickly and basically reached an agreement in Montreal, the Montreal Protocol, to eliminate the use of these CFCs. And that's been a very successful agreement. Since then, industry and companies have protected the ozone layer by removing the chlorine from these chemicals and producing what's called HFCs. So what happened on the weekend is, in recognition of the fact that these HFCs are very powerful greenhouse gases, countries got together and they agreed to amend the Montreal Protocol to also include HFCs.
Mm-hmm. And these are very powerful greenhouse gases, the HFCs?
These are some of the most powerful greenhouse gases you can find. Some HFCs are fine, but others are more than 100 times as powerful as carbon dioxide, in some cases well over 1,000 times.
Wow. And so the good news is that they got together to make this agreement, which will have a big impact.
It could potentially. I mean, the thought is that this would prevent a full degree Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. So this is a very important agreement, and it could actually have some very real and meaningful impacts.
All right. So much for the good news. What's the bad side? The bad thing about this?
Well, there are some criticisms of the agreement because countries like India, which has a fairly large manufacturing base, and they've received a very long lead time. They really don't have to start reducing their use of these chemicals until 2028. And the same goes for Pakistan and some of the other countries that they export to. The reason that's not as serious as it might sound is because as developed countries, including the US and, in the European Union, as they institute their own domestic rules, which they're already doing to eliminate these chemicals, the alternative products will become much more affordable, and then countries like India will be able to start using them without having to invest too heavily in the research and development phase. The real concern here in the U.S., after this agreement was reached, a number of media reports indicated a week ago that there would be no need for Senate ratification of this. And as we reported on Monday and as The Hill is reporting today, there's not much basis for that. This is a fairly substantial modification to an international treaty. And experts on international law point out that every previous amendment to this agreement has required Senate approval. And it's not just that the Senate has to approve it, but they need a two-thirds ratification vote.
We're going to get that in this Congress?
That's a very good question. Let's see what happens after this election, what the mood is like. The Senate, even the Republicans and so forth, have always been very supportive of efforts to protect the ozone layer. But we know that this is a climate agreement. This is designed to protect against global warming. And there's this ideology among some of these Republicans in the Senate that they just simply oppose any kind of an effort to protect the climate.
We'll wait to see what happens January 20th.
Yeah.
John Upton, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
To be with us. John Upton is a senior science writer for Climate Change. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about cyber warfare. There is a cyber attack going on as we speak on the internet. We'll talk a little bit about that. And then what are the rules of engagement? Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When we planned our next segment on cyber warfare, we had no idea that we'd be going on the air right in the middle of a cyber attack that is now taking place across the United States. We're in the middle of an attack that has taken out Netflix and Twitter and all kinds of other services. In fact, we can't even give you our Twitter at SciFry because we can't log on to that account. So, and it comes at a time when the U.S. intelligence community is confident that Russia has played a role in the recent hacking incidents in the U.S. We don't know if this attack is connected to anything like that. Those attacks, the U.S. intelligence communities have said, DNC, John Podesta's email, Vice President Joe Biden said last week on NBC's Meet the Press that some form of retaliation was being considered for those attacks and that the Russians would know it when they saw it. But are there any rules defining what constitutes an acceptable response? And when an attack comes from a soldier with a machine gun on the front lines, well, we know what to do then. But what happens with a coder at a keyboard in an office park? What makes for a fair fight in this situation? Joining me now to talk about it is Jason Healy. He's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs in New York, and he joins me from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here. I even gave my mustache some extra wax. So I've got some really good curl.
I thought
the listeners would appreciate it.
Are you aware of the attack going on now, the denial of service going on now?
Absolutely. Now, it's likely to be criminals rather than nation states, because it normally is a normally criminal thing. I'd be very surprised if this were the Russians, for example, trying to escalate by doing such an attack.
But when we talk about a cyber attack, and we talk about the rules of engagement here, would you not, I'm not saying again that this is that, as you say, is occurring, would you not sort of do a shot over the bow like this? It's not really taking out any vital hospitals or government agencies.
It's certainly the kind of thing that a nation might try and do. so much on this is trying to say, what are the rules of the road? Mm-hmm. And I'd be very surprised if the U.S. would try and do this as a shot across the bow to someone else, because we care too much about free speech to try and drown it out for a simple military purpose. But Russia, others, you know, they wouldn't feel so tight about that.
Mm-hmm. So we don't have any rules like the Geneva Conventions for a regular kind of warfare? There are no rules for what's fair game or how to do this correctly in a cyber warfare?
There are. Well, the nations are still trying to figure this out. So in general, the major countries have said that existing international law applies. Now, to the United States and other Western democracies, this means the Geneva Convention, that you can't, just like you can't drop a bomb on a hospital, you can't attack a hospital with cyber capabilities either. And so this has been the U.S. position and one of the rules of the road that we want to push. We didn't talk about rules of the road about releasing information to affect an election, attacking a motion picture company because you don't like the movie it's going to release.
Mm-hmm. But back in 2015, didn't the U.S. and China sign an agreement covering what we felt was fair in cyber warfare?
2015 was an incredible year. We went into 2015 with almost no international agreement on these rules of the road, and we ended up with not just President Obama of China and President Xi of the United States, but the entire G20 saying that you shouldn't attack a nation's infrastructure during peacetime, that you shouldn't conduct commercial espionage for your own company's profits. And it looks like China has, in fact, been living up to their side of the agreement.
Did Russia sign on to that agreement?
They did not. But our issues with Russia have been a little bit different. Well, they would have signed up as part of the G20 agreement. But really what they're doing now has been subtly different. You know, it hasn't been any of the things the U.S. specifically laid out as norms, the way that we think the world ought to work. And they've been doing other things, like releasing information.
Mm-hmm. If our Twitter account is not working, let's see if we can get the phone lines working. Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. Talking about the cyber warfare with Jay Healy from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. In traditional war, you've got clearly defined combatants and targets. Is it harder with computer attacks to trace responsibility back to where
Absolutely.
It started?
And this has been one of the reasons it's been so hard to try and come up with rules of the road, because if a nation wanted to, it could plausibly deny and say, we don't have anything here. And, you know, if you've been paying attention to the debates, that is coming up, right? How do you prove that someone is doing this when they're denying it? But we've gotten much, much better, both within the government and within the private sector, of coming in and having multiple lines of evidence. So there's some lines of evidence that say, look at these technical characteristics. This was written with a Cyrillic keyboard, and that's important to us. Another line of evidence says, well, after we've seen a particular group work dozens or even hundreds of times, we can figure out their style. I love the Ocean's 11 movies. And you know, if you know anything about crime, if you've been stolen from by the Ocean's 11 gang or the Night Fox, right? They're so different. And we can use that same kind of thinking to figure out which group is behind which attack. And then there's the context, the third element, where so often you can tell, that if, say, the North Koreans are walking away from the peace tables, that you're very likely to be getting a cyber attack coming from them. And different lines of evidence like that help so much in trying to figure out who did an attack.
So what do we need? Do we need an international agreement for all the countries, or are we covered enough, do you think?
We're still figuring that out. Certainly, the United States is at the position of we don't need to try and come up with another Geneva Convention. We have a Geneva Convention. And I think that's right, because trying to negotiate a new treaty would be incredibly difficult and would never happen. What the Russians and Chinese care about is information sovereignty. They want to stop any information that they think is a counter to their countries, counter to their regimes, and keep the information out. Obviously, that's anathema to the United States, and we want the free flow of information. So any treaty that we would try and start going down, this is going to be very difficult. So it turned out with China that the threat of sanctions, that indicting their officers, actually made a difference. They were very sensitive to those moves by the United States, and they backed down significantly. Putin we can see that with Crimea, with Ukraine, that he's much more resistant. And the United States' reply to this election hacking and the release of the emails is going to have to, I think, be probably quite a bit more muscular, as the vice president hinted at.
When you say that, and the vice president said they will know we're retaliating, how do you strike that balance between not going over the line somewhere that's going to escalate stuff?
You hear a lot from the cyber warriors, and they're coming out and they'll talk about cyber deterrence and things like that. And it's really less about things like cyber deterrence. I mean, we do want to make sure that we don't escalate. And I think there's a range of things that we can look at. For example, we can talk to our French and German allies, maybe even through NATO, because they have elections coming up too. And boy, wouldn't Putin like to get Angela Merkel out of office? Wouldn't he maybe like to get Marine Le Pen into office in France? So I think we can publicly work with our allies, and that will certainly be a signal that Putin recognizes. At U.S. Cyber Command, this is the U.S. military cyber warriors at Fort Meade. They've got people that are looking out into cyberspace and seeing and looking what the Russian groups are doing, waiting for that order from the president to disrupt them. And I would certainly expect that the president is going to give them the go order, not so that they can attack Russia, but that they can disrupt what the Russians are trying to get done to us.
Mm-hmm. 1-844-724-8255 is our number, and lots of people would like to talk to us. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Richard in Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
I'm concerned about the U.S. government itself working through surrogates or offshore companies to get cyber things done that it can't do as a government, such as the Equation Group. I want to know if your guest knows about that. And also its acquiescence of back doors into major router systems by major router manufacturers.
I will ask you. Thanks for calling. Can you translate that for us a bit, Jay?
Yeah, sure thing, Richard. Ira, and so what Richard is talking about here with this Equation Group is it's not only those bad Chinese and those evil Russians that are doing things online. Of course, the United States has been active in this for a very, very long time. That's the community that I come out of. And the Equation Group was the nickname given by a computer security company to a set of computer intrusions that they said, this is almost certainly going to be the NSA, the U.S. Signals Intelligence Agency, out conducting computer espionage out there in the world. And so the U.S. has said, yes, we absolutely do those things. The U.S. says, well, we're different because we'll spy on you on these things, but we won't, for example, take that information and give it to Boeing or Google or one of our other. So that's the way that we see the rules of the road, but of course not everyone else sees it the same way. And as far as the backdoor issue, so this is a technical issue of saying, if there is a U.S., especially a U.S. company that is selling software or hardware that the NSA or other parts of U.S. government like CIA would love to be able to get access to that to find out what messages are being passed or to try and be able to more easily defeat any encryption that the Russians or Iranians or North Koreans might be using on that. And here it's really difficult because this is the kind of thing that the intelligence community has been doing for decades. Yeah. But it was always on things that just the Soviet Union was doing. Nowadays, because then the Soviet Union was using different technology than we used in Arlington, Virginia, or in Peoria. Now, it's all the same technology. It's being used for military purposes, for espionage purposes, and we're all carrying it around in our pockets for phones or having it on our desktop. Mm-hmm. And so now those back doors are much more personal because it's affecting you and I.
Let's go to Irene in Chestnut Hill, Pennsylvania. Hi, Irene. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Thanks so much for taking my call. And I'm just wondering, you just talked about how technical this is. I've been surprised at the lack of outrage of people like not thinking this is important. And does that have something to do with us not policing it better or not being kind of astounded at what's going on because it is too technical or because we think it is something that's always happening to somebody else?
Yeah, good question.
It is a really fascinating question. Thank you. I think part of it is because so few of us understand the technology that's sitting in our pocket, that's sitting on our desktop, right? For most of us, we just look at it, and it's just magic. it's very difficult for us to know what's going on the end of that, right? You click send, and it goes, and it shows up somewhere else, and very few of us understand what happens behind that curtain. And so it's easy for us not to feel that disassociation from it because we don't fully understand it. Now, fortunately, what is happening at a certain, once we get past a certain level, like, for example, right now with the election hacks and the release of the information, we don't have a cyber problem. We have a Russia problem. And so that starts to take it out of this weird ones and zeros stuff that aren't very natural, and it puts it into more natural international affairs.
Yeah, we can understand. It relates to us. I'm Ira Flatow. Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about cyber warfare this hour with Jay Healy. And let's go to the phones. Let's go to another Jay in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Jay.
He has excellent taste in names, Ira.
Go ahead.
I want to address the topic that you guys were talking about right before you went to the phones, which is how do you know where an attack is coming from? And it's particularly well-timed given the attack this morning on a big DNS provider called Dyn, which affected, among other things, Twitter, and probably everybody being able to get to your Twitter feed, as you were talking about earlier. The attack that normally kills you in that kind of circumstance is called a distributed denial of service attack. And the distributed part's important. The way those attacks are usually conducted is by taking over a little piece of a whole bunch of computers, either by malware or spear phishing attacks or what have you, and originating just a few packets a second from tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of computers and aiming them at a specific target.
Jay, do you have a question? Because
yes.
I'm running out of time.
Yeah. Why is it that even though there's a defined protocol called BCP38 for that to be blocked by people like cable modem providers, why don't any of them implement it?
Okay.
Very few providers actually block forged packets.
All right. Well, why is it so? Why don't they do that? This Jay and Jay Healy and why?
Yeah. And first, it was how do you how can we know? And it's how do we know, for example, this is the Russians, or how can we figure out who is behind this attack? And if it's a single attack, it can be very difficult. But fortunately, with the Russians, with the Chinese, with others, we see this over a decade, over years, and you can start to build up a pattern. And that way, when you see the activity happen again, you have a much better sense. But I like what Jay was saying at was there's not just norms between nations. There are norms that happen amongst technologists. And many of these norms are incredibly strong. You know, right now, the norms to keep up the network, it doesn't matter what country it is, it doesn't matter what school you went to, it doesn't matter anything about you as an individual. Right now, we've got thousands of blessed nerds that are trying to get us past this denial of service attack because they have this common norm that you keep the network up. Now, not all of these norms are so well policed. For example, the one that Jay mentioned, that you don't pass the trash, essentially. And we haven't built up those norms yet of what network providers should do so they're not affecting others. They only worry about their own security, not what's happening downstream. That's why I love ideas like a sustainable internet. How can we make sure that our kids and grandkids are going to have an internet that's at least as safe, as clean, as awesome as the one that we have today? And ideas like sustainability will work towards the things that Jay brought up.
And what does that mean? And briefly, sustainable internet.
It starts looking at what are the practices that we have that are most sustainable, right? We just heard about the new agreement on HFCs, right? We're saying we're using this particular product and it's destroying the environment. That's not sustainable, so we'll make a substitute. Jay brought up the BCP38, this best community practice of what you're supposed to do, and it's being ignored, and it's affecting all of us. So if we take that same mindset of saying the internet's not going to be around, we can start looking at these non-sustainable practices.
Could you crack down on some of these people?
Absolutely, but whom would do that? In the United States, theoretically, you might have the FCC do that. You might... it's going to take some smart public policy to try and figure out the right ways. Where is naming and shaming enough? Where is regulation enough? You could cap and trade.
Yeah.
Just like you do for the environment.
All right. Thanks. Wow. Good day to have you on, Jay. Jay Healy, Senior Research Scholar at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs here in New York. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about our new educational outreach. Teachers, perk those ears up because we have something good for you coming. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, we often receive emails and letters from fans of our radio show, but one that we got this week was especially well-timed. It was from Ms. Larkin Beeman, a math and science teacher at East Middle School in Grand Junction, Colorado. And each Friday, she writes us, her seventh grade math students listen to Science Friday, and they draw or sketch what comes to their mind. Ms. Beeman writes, "All of their wanderings are so wonderful. I would really love to send you a sample of what your radio show brings up in the heads of middle schoolers. Thanks for your inspiration." Well, Ms. Beeman did send us a bunch of stuff that's really cool looking, and you can see the seventh graders' drawings on Tumblr, at our Tumblr site, sciencefriday.tumblr.com. Well, we love it when students, and teachers get inspired by what we do. And wouldn't you know it, we have a whole portion of our website dedicated to inspiring and educating students or anyone who wants to learn. And today we're unveiling the biggest, most ambitious education project we've ever attempted in our decades-long commitment to science education. It is called the Science Friday Educator Collaborative. Six teachers who have been inspired by Science Friday media, just like the kids in Ms. Beeman's class, these six teachers have put together a group of teaching resources that anyone can use to do the science that we cover here on the show. We have hands-on experiments and lessons and curricula. And in a minute, we'll meet a couple of those teachers and hear about what they have created. First, to kick it all off, I want to introduce Science Friday's Education Program Assistant, Xochi Garcia.
Hi, Xochi.
Tell us about Science Friday's education mission.
Well, part of our education mission at Science Friday is to take the amazing science stories covered by Science Friday each week and sort of figure out a way to have people do the science. So kind of what we're invested in is this idea that getting hands-on and nitty-gritty with science kind of helps people really connect to the stories that inspire them. So that's kind of what we do at Educate.
Mm-hmm. So this is the first year that we're doing this big, ambitious project together with these six teachers.
It is.
Tell us about the collaborative.
Okay, so the Science Friday Educator Collaborative is our newest education initiative. Basically, Ariel and I, who work in Educate, Ariel Zitch. We see teachers all the time, kind of like the teacher you spoke about earlier, who are inspired by Science Friday media and excited to teach these things to their students, and they have novel approaches to STEM education. And so we just want to show those approaches to a broader education audience, and we want to get some of our listeners involved in the types of projects that they create every day for their classroom. And it increases public awareness and appreciation of the STEM teaching profession. There are really creative educators out there, and they're doing this every day. And so we just kind of want to show the public what they have.
So we have these six teachers that we're collaborating with.
We do. And they're from all over the country. So we have teachers from California. One of our teachers, Ryan Hollister, he created this VR photosphere where you can actually go visit the columns of the giants in California, and you can pick up rocks and you can look at them and examine them for evidence of how that landscape was formed. And so these teachers are just really coming up with these amazing experiences for their students. And so we just kind of help them put these online so that other people can get to them.
It's great stuff. And then this is just the beginning, right? We're going to have a new class of educators next year.
Hopefully. I mean, this has been the best part of working at Science Friday. I mean, working at Science Friday is an amazing experience, and I feel very inspired on a weekly basis. But talking to these educators about what their ideas, I mean, they blew me out of the water. I mean, so we're going to run this annually, and it's because we want to get their voices out there and show their creative approaches. And so we will be opening a new application for educator collaborators in November. So we'll be rolling out these six resources in the fall. We have three of them up on Science Friday Educate right now. And we will be recruiting new teachers to join our new cohort.
So what? How are you going to handle these people? How do you handle new teachers who, all of them who are listening to us, who want to be part of this? How do they apply for this?
You can all apply. The applications aren't up yet, but if you go to sciencefriday.com/educate, you can find information about our current collaborators, as well as see their resources. And you can do two things. You can either check back to that site periodically, or you can sign up for our Educate newsletter, where they will get information about when the application goes up online.
Thank you, Xochi.
No problem.
Xochi Garcia is a Science Friday's education program assistant. Now let's go talk to some of those teachers. We're going to be joined by two of the teachers in this inaugural class of Science Friday's Educator Collaborative. Ryan Becker teaches physical science. I used to love it when they said that. It's physics at Woodstock Union Middle School in Woodstock, Vermont. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Catherine Hinkle is an earth science teacher at Innovation Academy Charter School in Tingsboro, Massachusetts. That's near Lowell, outside of Boston, right, Catherine?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, thank you both for being with us today. Let me begin with Ryan. Your work on illustrated graphics was inspired by a profile we did on a woman named Jill Peto, right?
Yeah, so my work was 100% inspired by the work of Jill Pelto, who's an artist and scientist, and she's created this really unique approach that meshes art and scientific data in what, in my resource, I refer to as illustrated graphs.
Hmm. And they're beautiful because they're very well done, and you can hardly, you know, see, it looks like there's terrain there, but it's actually little peaks and valleys of a graphs sort of sunk into it.
Absolutely. So illustrated graphs, the idea is that they convey visual stories about real scientific data, and they can touch on current impacts or even implications or personal experiences. And they're created using whatever medium that the artist wants. Pelto uses watercolor paints, but you could use digital mashups. You could use markers, pencil, and all can be equally effective. And I think what you touched on was that defining feature of illustrated graphs, and what makes them more than just pieces of art is the fact that they really strategically incorporate that line or curve of the graph as part of the visual story they're trying to tell about the data.
And Catherine, your resource is the albedo effect. What Science Friday Media inspired that? Tell us about that effect and why you used it.
Yeah, I was inspired by an interview that I heard Science Friday associate producer Alexa Lim talk to a couple of research ecologists about the urban heat island effect. And I wanted to take that concept and apply it to an engineering design challenge. So my students were asked to take a situation where a hypothetical school has to hold recess in their parking lot. But at certain times of the year, because of how hot it gets, because of the black pavement, it's very uncomfortable to go out and play. So they need to design components that can lower the temperature on the parking lot, but as well as maintain a certain number of parking spaces.
So I looked at it. It's a great little project. They're going out and measuring surfaces to see how much heat is reflected, sunlight, and is reflected off different surfaces, leaves or concrete or asphalt and stuff like that. To see the differences, measure the albedo, the reflectivity of it.
Yeah, that's right. And then they can take their data of that study and then apply it to how they want to, you know, add those components into the parking lot space to cool down the temperature. And then they take their studies and share out their designs. And then we think about a more global issue of how albedo affects melting ice caps. And I have them listen to an interview with Alan Shepard, who's the director of polar observation and modeling, when he came on the show and talked about superglacial lakes and how that accelerates the melting of Greenland's ice sheets.
You know, as a student of history of science, I was struck that you're actually recreating sort of an experiment that Benjamin Franklin did. And he took out many different materials onto the snow and saw how black and white and what different colors were melting into the snow. So it was sort of a historical event that you've got going on there.
Yeah, that's a wonderful connection.
And Ryan, do you teach the teachers how to creatively represent the data? Do you give them some ideas or walk them through that?
Yeah, so I don't know that I teach them, because I really think part of the artistic process is that artistic freedom that's there. But my resource is designed to really act as a guide to help teachers bring this creative approach into their classroom.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in this?
So my encounter with the Educator Collaborative, I think, happened through a tweet. So I'm pretty active on Twitter for science purposes and professional development. And I believe I saw a tweet that was about this opportunity, and it seemed exciting. And so I applied, and with the help of the folks in my application, I was lucky enough to be accepted, and I'm here today.
Yeah, that was my same experience. It was following on Twitter, and I go to Science Friday all the time for my lesson plan, so I saw that pop up.
And Sochi, how did you find these teachers? Did they find us?
Kind of like what Catherine and Ryan said, a lot of teachers found us on Twitter, but we also have a lot of partner organizations that we work with, and we were lucky that Math for America also put it out to their teachers to kind of sign up for this program, and that's how we got one of our educators, Samantha Adams. So a lot of the organizations we work with in 100K and 10 put this out to teachers that they work with in order to get like a wide net cast. So and we had a lot of Science Friday listeners, a lot of dedicated teachers listen to Science Friday on a weekly basis. And so we had a lot of applications from educators who just are Science Friday fans.
Mm-hmm. And how difficult is it for teachers to do these projects?
So, I mean, kind of what we are trying to do with the collaborative is take advantage of the resources or kind of experiences that teachers already create using Science Friday media in their classroom. And so really, I think this is for any experienced STEM educator. So if you've had a number of years in the classroom and you are feeling excited about bringing current science and current media into your class, and that's something that you do, this is the opportunity for you to put that approach out there. And so I encourage everyone to apply. I know I shouldn't probably say that on air.
No, it's good. We want to get as many people involved.
Yeah.
You know, I also want to know, and I'll ask Catherine this question. I've been following, the state of teacherdom for many, many years. And over the years, we keep hearing that many, many teachers who actually become science teachers are not science teachers to begin with. And therefore, they have trouble teaching science. Let me first remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio, Public Radio International. And is it possible, Catherine, do you think that teachers who maybe were once social studies teachers can follow these lessons very well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially with the aid of such wonderful media on Science Friday, because, really it's just about getting students involved in creative projects that help them work on fundamental skills that apply across the curriculum mm-hmm. and supporting them in that.
Let me see if I can go to the phones. Let's see if we can. Yeah, let's go to Mark in Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Mark, are you there? Whoa, I'm having cell phone problems. Something I'm going to drop out of that. But when he was making an interesting comment, and I want to make that to Ryan, is that basically he said, STEM, which we all talk about, science, technology, engineering, and math. Let me ask all of you, this is really the STEAM part, where you put the arts and turn STEM into STEAM. And this, the kinds of things that you're doing really is sort of turning them into artwork, isn't it? And Catherine, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that students really just want to do something tangible with their hands. They want to create. They're inherently and naturally creative. And our job really is just finding the right projects for them that where they can channel those creative ideas and what they already have.
And what do you do in your classroom? What kind of satisfaction do you get when you see the kids doing all this kind of stuff?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, the best day is when no one is, they're all so immersed in their own projects that they barely know that I'm there. And that's a really good day when they are just so invested inherently in their project and doing well. That's mm-hmm. when I'm at my happiest.
And Ryan, when you incorporate artwork into your graphs, How do you choose what kind of artwork, whether it's going to be a forest or a rock formation or something like that? Do you keep the kids in mind for that?
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the real positives of the resource that I created, and it's bringing to all as many of my assignments as possible, is this degree of choice. And so the ability to turn it over to students and let them have choice in what they're trying to represent and how they're trying to represent it, I think is a real strength.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I'm always trying to bring into the classroom.
Yeah. And Catherine, what do you say to people who think that science teachers can't be creative?
Oh, no. I want everyone to know that being a science teacher is incredibly creative and fun, too. And, you know, we certainly have content standards that we have to work within. But, you know, how we present our material to the students and the projects and work we give them to engage them and work on their skills, it's a craft. And it's, you know, it's never boring. It always changes. And that's not to say it's not hard, but it's certainly, you know, worth doing and a lot of fun.
Do the kids look forward to doing these things?
I hope so. I think so. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, because they get their hands on stuff. They get to go outside and explore and look at the world around them. Xochi, I'm sure you were thinking about that.
I mean, I was definitely thinking about every single one of these resources when I received the pitch, because part of our process is that they sort of choose a piece of media and pitch kind of what they want to write. And I was just so jazzed to hear about each one of these. So as a lifelong learner, I kind of wanted to engage in these right away. So I think there's definitely a measure of excitement about each resource. And it's part of that educator's excitement gets communicated.
Yeah, because we have been talking about with the Science Club, go out and explore things.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is just taking it, you know, on steroids, so to speak.
It really is. It's like Teacher's Science Club, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today and inviting all teachers. We have these free resources up on our website now at sciencefriday.com/educate. Xochi Garcia, Science Friday's Education Program Assistant, thank you.
Thank you for
having me. Thanks for all you do for us. Ryan Becker teaches physics at Woodstock Union Middle School in Woodstock, Vermont, and Catherine Hinkle, Earth Science Teacher at Innovation Academy Charter School in Tingsboro, Massachusetts.
Thank you.
We'll be checking back with you. Good luck with your projects.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. So go right back, get on that website. It's up there, sciencefriday.com/educate. You're gonna have a great time with this. I'm going on there because I love this kind of stuff. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.